I'm sorry, 05-1516, the Coca-Cola Company versus Tarabul. Let's see, Mr. Potter?
Yes.
You've reserved 5 minutes for your for rebuttal purposes, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Well, you can go ahead whenever you're ready.
If it may please the court, my name is Emery Potter, and I, along with my co-counsel Terry Kaplan, represent Mr. Michael Tarabula in this case.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's Tarabula, not Tarabula.
Yes.
Tarabula. Okay.
One of the most interesting and pivotal issues in this case, and I figured I'd start with it, is the this looks, based upon the research on both sides and the lower court, to be a case of first impression under U.S. patent law. Never before under Section 256 action has a challenger met the burden to prove by clear, convincing, and corroborated evidence prior, independent conception and reduction to practice. Yet the trial court found that Mr. Tarabula had proved by clear, convincing, and corroborated evidence that in 1992 or 1993 he conceived of the design embodied in the 791 patent at issue in this action.
Okay. Well, let me ask you though. You're coming here at least on appeal, and you're claiming sole inventorship, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And so I want to get to what you think the burden of proof was with respect to your client. And there are a number of cases, including one called Thompson versus Haynes. And my understanding of that case is that you need evidence to show that the named inventors did not contribute to the invention. Are we all in agreement that that was your burden, to show that the named inventors did not contribute to the invention?
Now, the Thomas B. Haynes case is a contribution case, which is differentiated from this case because there is no claim of contribution. These parties did not work together. They did not work in concert.
So what is your view on what the burden was for your client, and what case do you cite for that?
Well, I think it's all pretty well spelled out in the Ethicon case that my client is required to prove his conception and reduction to practice by clear, convincing, and corroborated evidence. And he did so. The question then becomes is, once that happens, what happens to the presumption of inventorship on behalf of the inventors? And we have three named inventors in this case: George Thompson, Leonard Antow, and Tran Minh. And it's pretty clear, if you look at it, that two inventors essentially admitted that they did not do anything with regard to the conception of this invention. Mr. Thompson at 421 through 422, and Mr. Antow at 301 versus 303. So what we had done at that point is met our burden of proving when my client conceived and reduced to practice, and also showed that two named inventors did nothing with regard to the conception of the invention. At this point, there's a presumption of correctness on behalf of a patentist to the named inventors. But at this point, we have testimony, have elicited testimony at trial, that some of the inventors are incorrectly named. I don't know at which point this presumption.
But if your claim is exclusively as the sole inventor, don't you have to show that all of them are incorrectly named? I mean, where does it get you that two out of the four might have been incorrectly named if you're claiming sole inventorship?
Oh, no, Your Honor. I do not disagree that I have to show that they were not all incorrectly named. What I'm saying, I'm talking toward the presumption that they were afforded. In my review of the lower court's opinion, the presumption was given to them almost entirely as a shield, and not, we had overcome at least part of that presumption to where there was a duty on the behalf of the Coca-Cola Company, actually on behalf of the named inventors, to come forth and show that they did in fact invent, since Mr. Tarabula had shown that in 1992 or 1993 he conceived of it. In 1994 he delivered a fully realized prototype to the Coca-Cola Company. Now they had been, at that time there had been full disclosure of his ideas. Based on the evidence that was adduced at trial, it's pretty clear that they had not begun on this particular invention. The particular invention being a vending machine face with a Coke bottle placed on in a very specific manner. The testimony at trial showed that, under Burroughs v. Welcome, the formulation in the mind of the inventor has to be a definite and permanent idea of the complete and operative invention. Yet, the Coca-Cola Company has admitted through Mr. Antow's testimony, which is cited in the reply brief, that it was not until August of 1994 that they even began thinking of vending machines.
The court used the operative date being sometime in March of 1995, is that correct?
The court used the operative date being March of 1995. That is when the named inventors contacted Mr. Terebiula to discuss his prototype.
You're not contending that the named inventors had any information about his prototype before March of 1995?
I have no way of knowing whether they do or do not. All I know is that it was inside Coca-Cola's compound.
But you're not contending at this point that before March of 1995 that the named inventors had any information about Mr. Terebiula's supposed invention?
Other than what they may have learned through the Coca-Cola Company being in the same building with where the invention had been for a year.
But you didn't contend that. You didn't ask that there be an inference that they had access to this material that was elsewhere in the Coca-Cola building. You admitted that they didn't have any information about Mr. Terebiula's invention until March of 1995, right?
I do not recall admitting that they had no information about that.
So are you suggesting that your case is predicated on our concluding that that was not the correct operative date, and that therefore if the date was March 1995, the case is over?
No, I do not. If the court goes under the assumption that the first time that the named inventors saw this invention was in March of 1995, I still believe that Mr. Terebiula prevails in this action, because he has conceived it and reduced to practice, and that there is no evidence whatsoever of conception prior to Mr. Terebiula's delivery of the prototype in 94 or his meeting with the inventors when they claimed to have first saw it in 1994. What we have is...
There's no evidence that they did anything, these inventors did anything before March of 1995?
No, Your Honor, what we have is a meeting that was attended by a great deal of people. It was a brainstorming meeting where somebody said, "Bender looks like a contour bottle." Mr. Terebiula is described in Coca-Cola documents as a vendor.
Yeah, but they came up with a sketch in October of 1994. Forget about the February 1994 meeting. They came up with a sketch.
Who's the they that came up with the sketch? And that becomes a very important issue, because Mr. Min did not draw that sketch. Mr. Thompson did not draw that sketch, nor did Mr. Antow draw that sketch. In fact, Mr. Antow and Mr. Arthur Rudick went to an outside vendor and said, "We want to make some vending machines that are really interesting. Draw some concept sketches." And an individual by the name of Willis Whiteside drew a whole bunch of sketches, and if you look in the record, there are a great deal there. Furthermore, there are a lot more sketches, and those were not conceived by any of the named inventors.
What's the basis for that statement?
How do we show that design? First of all, the design in that drawing.
You made a statement. What's the basis for it in the record?
The basis for it in the record is that they commissioned sketches from an outside vendor to give concepts for a vending machine. They didn't say, "Draw me a simple vending machine in which we can place a Coke bottle in a certain space on there," because this patent is a very specific design. Yet we dispute, of course, that the designs that were drawn by Mr. Willis Whiteside, the things that were conceived of by Mr. Willis Whiteside, are different than the 791 patent. There are multiple differences, and there are multiple designs. In fact, there were so many different concept sketches looked at through this entire procedure that suddenly that this would mean that Mr. Antow, Mr. Min, and Mr. Thompson conceived of every single design that someone brought them as a possible concept. That seems to me a bit far-fetched, that all of a sudden somebody draws them a concept sketch, and suddenly they are the ones that invented that and conceived of each one of those. They didn't. Another person drew them a whole bunch of concept sketches, and that's all they've been able to come up with. In fact, the first time we see any steps taken in any direction is after the interview of Mr. Terabula, is when they go off to someone and give the exact same design as Mr. Terabula. And so we're faced with a situation where an outside vendor has come up with these ideas and he's not named in the patent. Why wasn't he named? And since Mr. Rudick and Mr. Antow are the ones that told him to draw things, why isn't Mr. Rudick named? Mr. Antow has already admitted he gave no specific concepts toward the conception of that. So, if Mr. Rudick is not named, Mr. Antow gave no conceptual, did not conceive of the invention, how can we suddenly import this outside design through Rudick and Antow and suddenly get Antow onto the patent? It doesn't make any sense. Essentially, what the Coca-Cola Company has done is gone through all the different conceptual sketches that they had and said, ooh, here's one that might be close. We're going to say this is previous conception. But it's not previous conception because it wasn't conceived of by the named inventors, which is one of the I've gone over my time.
You want to save the rest of your time?
If the court has no further questions for me at this point.
No, you'll have your full 5 minutes of rebuttal, Mr. Potter. We'll hear from the Coca-Cola Company. Mr. Reichman?
Yes, sir. May it please the court. The central dispute between the parties in this case is what is the legal standard governing a sole inventorship case? More particularly, what does a challenger have to prove to be substituted as the sole inventor on a patent?
Well, what was the evidence? Why don't you respond to the other side's view about whether there was any evidence and what that evidence was with respect to conception by the inventors before March of 95?
Okay. There was, in fact, plenty of evidence of conception. I need to start when talking about the evidence, of course, by reminding the court what we all know, which is that there no evidence needed to be presented, of course, because there was a presumption that the named inventors were the true and correct inventors. But nonetheless, there was plenty of evidence presented. For one, there was the inventor's testimony. Let's start with that. All the inventors testified that they had this idea before the key date, March of 1995, when they first became aware of Mr. Terabula's invention. In addition to the named inventors, we also have two other Coca-Cola employees, Art Rudick and Ray Morgan, who testified that they, in the circle of people working on this, were aware of this idea before Mr. Terabula showed up. In addition to that, we have the brainstorming meeting memo, which says vendor that looks like a contour bottle. And the inventors testified, two of the three who were at that meeting, testified that vendor looks like a contour bottle means a vendor with a 3D contour face on its front, in addition to other things.
Well, what was the testimony about the contribution of the three named inventors to the October 1994 sketch?
Well, there's several different places in the record that it appears, but one is A390, for example, where it starts on 390. Mr. Potter just asked you whether these sketches were done by an outside supplier, and they were, right? Yes, sir, they were. A supplier under contract with the company to do these. This is a supplier under contract with the company, a supplier that was paid to do these sketches, and in the second generation, we had directed them as to what the elements were, what the themes would be for in these sketches. And along the lines of the Hoop case, where it says that an inventor may use the services of others to perfect the invention, what they were doing was perfecting it by having an outside sketch company do these drawings. One thing that's important is I think that we have record evidence, and there's more cited in the brief, and I can give you more about their working with the sketch artist. But let's put that aside. Let's start.
Right. I just want to make sure the sketches you're referring to, when you say the sketches that were commissioned,
yes,
and that I think Judge Dyke was referring to, just for the record, they're the sketches that begin at specifically at 647 of the joint appendix and go through, I believe it's 654. Is that correct? These are the sketches that Mr. Antow commissioned, right? That you're referring to.
Yes, and as part of that, I also believe that the evidence reflects that what is separately marked as Exhibit 282 at Appendix 598. This is the best picture of it.
I see, okay.
Most easily.
So the pages I mentioned plus 598, those, when we're talking about the sketches that were commissioned, this is what we're talking about.
I have them as being A641.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, there were some additional building sketches.
A654, just
okay.
To be entirely
all right. I just want to make sure we were all talking about the same sketches.
We are.
I'm sorry, go ahead and with what you were saying.
My point was that let's put aside the question, pretermitted for the time being, about what the inventor's collaboration with the outside sketch artists was. It's undisputed, and there can be no doubt, that they had these sketches. Two of the three named inventors had this sketch, 282, in hand, months before Mr. Terebiula showed up. So how can it be said that Mr. Terebiula invented this when they already had it in hand?
And you're saying that under the law here, the judge said it didn't matter if, in fact, Mr. Terebiula thought of it before the named inventors. The point is that they had conceived it or thought of it before the point at which he came in.
That's right. And I'm going to simplify the facts. I don't think this is exactly the way the facts lay out, but just for purposes of demonstrating what the point that you're making. Let's say, as the court found, he invents in 92, but he doesn't tell anybody. Then Coca-Cola invents in 94. Then Terebiula shows up in 95. Is he entitled to substitution years after the fact under Section 256? And we say absolutely not. Maybe if he had provoked an interference proceeding. Although I doubt it, if this was a derivation.
Do you agree, Mr. Reichman, with Mr. Potter, that this is a case of first impression? He said that at the start of his presentation. In other words, is there any case that speaks to this and that sort of approves of the legal standard that the district court employed here directly? I mean, do we have any case that's on point with this?
Well, my brother's point was that there's never been a case where there's been a substitution before, so you're treading in uncharted territory, and that's not true. There's the University of Colorado versus American Sinemet case, which is 342 F3rd 1298. It's a 2003 case. And I want to, if I can, I want to just take a moment and tell you about that case because it rebuts his point that what we've got here is an impossible standard.
Is that cited in your brief?
No, sir.
Did you tell him about it before the argument that you were going to refer?
I didn't know he was going to get up and say there's never been a published case. And there, in fact, has been a published case.
You should tell him about it. Go ahead.
In the University of Colorado case, what happens is you have the named inventor. He asks doctors at the university to do some comparative efficacy tests. They go off and they do those tests, but in the course of it, they discover something on their own, that there's a way to make the drug even better. They write the named inventor. They tell him about it. Then they send him an unpublished manuscript that lays out how to do this thing in a much better way. The named inventor takes that manuscript and copies it wholesale, parts of it wholesale, into a patent. They find out about it and are upset, and they file an action under 256 saying that he should be removed and that they should be added. In other words, total substitution. And the court agrees. This court agrees that they had proved that they were the sole inventor. It wasn't impossible. There was a strong inference based on the fact that the named inventor had copied wholesale their submission that corroborated their claim that they should be substituted as the sole inventor. That's the type of evidence that's contemplated when you're taking the extraordinary act of changing an issued patent. Not that we've got five witnesses and multiple documents corroborating that there was prior conception before the disclosure. And all we have on Mr. Terebiula's side is he just simply doesn't believe it. He doesn't believe it's possible.
Let me ask, this case is a little unusual. At least I haven't seen one quite like it, to the extent that the case went to the jury. The jury hung, and then the district court granted JMAW. Did something happen, or isn't that a little unusual?
Well, the Rule 50 contemplates that you would have a mistrial and that you could also have a judgment as a matter of law. So it is contemplated by the rules, and although I don't have one in my outline, there are cases out there where that happens. I'll tell you why, as a practical matter, it happened. You can see it in the judge's comments before we started with the case. when we walked in the room to start with the jury, the judge said, well, this case is about who came up with the most economical way to produce this vendor. It's not about the idea of a bottle on a vendor, because that's an old idea, like Nostradamus. And we said, no, Judge, that is what this case is about. And frankly, I think once the evidence laid out, he realized that this was a judgment as a matter of law case, notwithstanding that the jury may have been persuaded, some of them may have been persuaded on certain issues. So I don't think that is all that extraordinary.
And you're saying what it really comes down to, your argument is that, I guess has to be, and correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Reichman, that it was proper for the judge to conclude that Mr. Potter could not carry the burden of under the evidence of establishing by clear and convincing evidence that the Coca-Cola people had not thought of this before they had the March 1995 meeting with Mr. Tarabula.
That's precisely what the court held. He did note, however, properly, that even if he switched the burden the way that Tarabula wanted the burden to be switched, Coca-Cola would nonetheless have prevailed because the evidence was uncontroverted that they had thought about this before. Mr. Tarabula admitted that he had no idea what was going on at the Coca-Cola company before, and there was no evidence to contradict their clear and unequivocal testimony and supporting documents.
Now, there was, I believe, evidence to the effect, and I don't think it's disputed, that Mr. Tarabula was doing photographic work as a sort of a contract or freelance photographer for Coca-Cola from time to time?
For over 10 years.
Oh, yeah, okay.
He was
fair enough.
Outstanding, and that is part of why we made sure it was clear in our papers and when discussing it with the judge below, that the fact that he slipped this idea into Coca-Cola was no reflection of anybody's interest in it. He was a long-standing vendor under a very tight contract with the company.
Now let me just, excuse me for cutting you off, but the time goes quickly. Now, he meets with Mr. Antow in March of 95, correct?
Yes.
They had a meeting with Mr. Tarabula met with Mr. Min and Mr. Antow. Is it Antow or Antow?
It's Antow, taking the evidence in his favor.
Now, there was a meeting, I think in the record there's a reflection of March of 94. Mr. Tarabula gave a prototype of some kind to Mr. Gargis and Mr. Greenwood. What is that? What was involved there?
Mr. Tarabula was a long-standing photographer for the company dating back to the 80s, perhaps even before, back to 1972. He photographs bottles with the splash effect on there, and from all accounts, it was a great relationship. They were there having nothing to do with this.
They were in his studio or his office.
His studio on a totally unrelated matter. Unbeknownst to them, Mr. Tarabula, in his spare time, had been tinkering and come up with this prototype. They're sitting there, and he said, hey, do you want to see something I invented? I said, sure. He pulled it out, and I said, that looks pretty cool. And they said, will you show it around? They said, sure, we will. The meeting wasn't a meeting about this. It was a meeting about something totally unrelated. Mr. Tarabula, unsolicited, brought the thing out. And the point that we made and continue to make is that they felt comfortable even talking to the guy about it because he was a long-standing.
Is there anything in the record reflecting what it's Mr. Gargis and Mr. Greenwood?
Gargis and Greenwood.
Gargis and Greenwood. What they did with that little prototype that he presented to them?
Absolutely. The record shows that they brought it back. Well, let me start with the punchline and then work backwards. The punchline is the undisputed evidence in the record is that the named inventors never laid eyes on the thing, heard about it, had any contact or anything about it until March of 1995. So the question is, what happened between March of 94 and March of 95? What happens is Mr. Tarabula delivers the prototype to Coca-Cola in the name of Mr. Gargis, who then gets it, keeps it on his desk for a while, then finds out who it is he's got to send it to, is our outside submission guy, you know, when you get things off the street, sends it to the guy who loses it for a while. Then Mr. Tarabula calls and says, hey, have you looked at my idea yet? He says, yeah, we're not done with that yet, but I'm going to have
to... He calls Gargis.
He calls Gargis, and then he calls Womack, who's the outside submission guy. He calls Womack, have you looked at my idea? Not yet, we're not done looking at it, but I'm going to have Legal get in touch with you. Legal then gets in touch with Mr. Tarabula in the fall of 1994 and says you have to sign our outside of the submission agreement before we'll even look at your thing. Consults with the lawyer. He signs it. Then Mr. Womack retires, sitting on his shelf. Mr. Tarabella calls the legal department in March of 95 and says, where is it? She goes and finds it sitting on a shelf, and she sends it over for the first time in March of 1995 to the named inventors. And it's undisputed that that's the first time that they saw this. And that's why, ultimately, the district court did the correct thing, said what had been conceived, what did the named inventors know as of March of 1995 when they first received Mr. Tarabella's submission.
So it'd be a much different case, you would say, Mr. Reichman, if in fact the gentleman that Mr. Tarabella had met in 94 were, instead of Mr. Gargis and Mr. Greenwood, had been Mr. Antow and or Mr. Min. It'd
be a closer case. I think we still would prevail, but it'd be a closer case.
But wouldn't you agree that a jury under those circumstances, that in Judge Schall's hypothetical, could find that Mr. Tarabella was an inventor?
Well, no, I will not concede that he could be the sole inventor, for sure.
No, but I didn't. Yeah, that was my question.
Well, I wanted to
make
sure
he contributed to it. If he had shown the shoebox design to them in March of 1994, and they had filed this design patent, couldn't a jury conclude that he had contributed to the design patent under those circumstances?
No, our position is that based on the inventor's testimony, that they had thought of it before then, corroborated by, you don't need corroboration, but corroborated by both the two other non-inventors' testimony and the February of 1994 memo, that he couldn't overcome the presumption of correctness in that.
A jury couldn't infer that under those circumstances that they saw it and used his design.
Well, when the testimony of five witnesses and then you have a document is that they had thought of it before. Conception is in the mind, not on a piece of paper. And there are other cases that talk about how you can't, that overturn a jury verdict for making an improper inference based on simply the timeline by saying that they weren't talking about it before and they were talking about it after the fact. There was judgment as a matter of law overturning a jury verdict, and that was the only basis for drawing the inference. But in this case, we have a presumption.
What case is that?
That is the, give me a moment. Eli Lilly versus Aradigm case 376, F3rd 1352.
Mr. Reichman, I just want to ask you before your time, 376 Fed 3rd 1352?
Yes, sir.
I just want to ask you, because your time is finished, before you sit down, I want to make sure I got the citation correctly of that case you mentioned earlier, I think you referred to it as the Colorado case. Is that 342 Fed 3rd 1298?
Yes, it is. University of Colorado versus American
Sign. Okay. All right. Well, okay. Thank you, Mr. Reichman. All right, Mr. Potter, as I said, you have your full 5 minutes.
One of the things we have to remember at the beginning of this is that it's the ordinary observer standard. If you look at 598, which is the conceptual sketch drawn by someone else than any of the three inventors, and then you look at the backlit vending machine that was produced, and then you look at Mr. Tarabella's prototype, which has been called a shoebox prototype, which is not. It's a plastic case that was fashioned by Mr. Tarabella with lighting systems and other items than that.
But it's about the size of a shoebox. Yeah. That's the point.
Yes. And you notice an ordinary observer is going to say that this looks like this. But an ordinary observer is not going to say that this looks like either of them, because this is a completely different item. We have to realize that the concept sketch does not resemble. Now, what there is not, and what amazes me that there is not, especially in a company like the Coca-Cola Company that is so protective of its trademarks and its ideas, is there are no logbooks, there are no sketches, there is nothing that was produced by any of the named inventors. There is no proof of their conception. All we have is an outside vendor. Now, they say that this deals with the issue of someone who, ordinary skill, who goes out and does something for them. But what they did was they